Hello. You say the Citizens Council was calling you all day yesterday?
Well, they call all. They call all day, every day, and they just hang up the phones, and they it's a form of intimidation and harassment that they go through. So we decided we would give them a taste of their own medicine by calling them. We have a committee call them all day. So now their phone's tied up, and our phone's tied up too.
Yes. Yes. Let's cut back to personal matters for a moment, if we may. How did you get involved in the movement? I know you weren't, you were a physical education work before you came here, weren't you? Is that right?
Well, actually, I've been involved in the movement since I was just a boy. Now, what happened, Medgen and I had worked at this as a team together from boys up.
I see.
We organized chapters in over in Newton County and over in the Lauder County, in Neshoba County, in Winston County. And then up in the Delta section when we were in our teens, in our early 20s. And then I was in the funeral business in
Cabin,
over in Neshoba County, Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Oh, yes.
And I was president of the Negro Voters League, and I was trying to get Negroes registered to vote. And I had many hardships, many economic pressure was applied to me in my business, and they forced me out of business in 1957. At the same time, I was president of our local branch there and also president of the Negro Voters League of Mississippi. And therefore, after they broke me, they sued me a couple of lawsuits. I was a fine, and I was sued for personal damages. A white lady was parked, I was parked at an intersection. A white lady was on the parking lot. And she got in her car and ran into me and tore my car. And they sued me for $5,000, claiming that I had injured her back, and that was confirmed by the courts. Then they also
appealed.
No one would represent me. I couldn't get an attorney to represent me. Then I went to St. Louis to a meeting, to these National Funeral Directors meeting. And while I was there, my wife was attending a funeral that we had. The person had died, and she was carrying one to the cemetery with the funeral procession. And a white man ran through the funeral procession and tore my ambulance with the body in it, and they sued me again for that and fined me a tremendous sum. So then they began to. I was the first Negro disc jockey in Mississippi. They got me fired from the radio station in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
That's your picture on the wall there, isn't it?
Yes.
The picture to the right of the letter from President Johnson.
Yes.
And,
that's it.
And your brother.
Yes, and President Kennedy, too. That's President Kennedy.
And on the left there is President, on the left is President Kennedy, and that's it your family?
No, that's my brother's family.
Your brother's family.
That's when we were attending the funeral of my
the
brother
funeral
in Washington.
Your brother.
Yes, we were guests of the President
yes,
at the time.
Yes, I had read that.
So, as I was going on to say about the wreck that happened on my wife's funeral procession, they sued me for that, then they began to apply pressure all over. They got me fired from the radio station. Then they got me fired from, I had a restaurant downtown in Philadelphia, and they closed it up, revoked my license. And then they began to not let me ask the casket companies who were selling me casket and embalming fluid not to sell me casket, not let me have fluid. And they applied so much pressure to me, and they, until I had no choice. I had to give up my business and seek employment then, which I had never had a job before. I worked for my father and my uncle in the funeral business, and I've been in my own business for years. Then I began to look for employment. I couldn't find anywhere in the state, so I told Medgar, I said, look, Medgar, I'm going to go away and get a job, and I'll send money, but you stay here and keep carrying the fight on, and I'll go and send money back and try to buy some property and get enough income. And then within 5 years, I'll come back and we'll have enough money that we can continue to fight and get our people free and free ourselves. And I said, but anytime you need me, I'll be back, whether it's day or night. And so we agreed, and then I told him, I said, but I remember the pact that we made when we were boys, that whatever happened to one of us, the other would carry on until the same thing happened to him, until he could not, until physically he would be prevented, or until something else that we couldn't help.
This is your agreement as boys?
Yeah, we must have been about, I must have been around 15, I guess Metcalf must have been around 12. While we said this, it was one day we were sitting at the Billboard, at that time, the late Senator Billboard, was campaigning for re-election. And he'd come to our home every year, every time of election. He would stomp and scotch, and he would lambast the Negroes and talk about you're going to send them back to Africa. And
which town is this now?
Decatur, Mississippi. That's
Decatur.
The county seat of Newton County.
Yes.
And so this particular, but we'd always go and listen to him, you know. We were about the only Negroes who would go up and listen. And we'd always go and sit right in front of him. Because my dad had always taught us that we were good as anybody. And that regards to a man's color, it had nothing to do with him as an individual. And God loved us all, and we were all God's chosen children, and we had the rights and privileges of anyone else. So we felt that way. It was brought up in us. And we would go up and listen to him speak. We were sitting down in front of him this particular day, and he said, and I remember very clearly, he said, "You see these two niggas down here? If you don't keep them in that place, someday they'll be in Washington trying to represent you, taking my place and the rest of the good white people's place." And I sort of looked up at him and smiled at him. And he said, he even got nerve to grin at me. And then at that day, Metcalfe and I said, "Well, someday he may be telling the truth." And Metcalfe said, "You're right, Charlie. Someday we may be in Washington representing all the people of Mississippi." And from that day on, we've decided that's something we could do. And then just a few days later, a few months later, a friend of my dad's was lynched. He was accused of insulting a white woman. They came and got him and dragged him out of his home, hooked him behind a wagon and drug him down the streets into a pasture down not too far from our home and hung him to a tree and stood off and shot him in two with shotgun until part of his body fell to the ground. And his clothes lay there in the pasture for weeks and weeks, and we used to go by and see them.
What year was this, approximately?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say. It must have been 1930, maybe 7, 38, maybe.
You remember his name?
Yes, Mr. Tingle.
Tingle?
Tingle. His last name was Tingle.
T-I-N-G-L-E?
Yes. It hurt my dad, it hurt us. We asked Dad, "Dad, why did he do it? Why did he do it?" He said, "Well, son, just because he's a Negro." And I said, "Well, isn't that something we can do, something that Negroes can do, something that the law would do to stop people from doing this?" And Dad referred to it. He said, "The law themselves encourage that type of thing in Mississippi." He said, "We're going to have to straighten that out ourselves." And that's one of the most important things, I think, that made Meg and I more determined to become fighters for equality for all men, not just Negroes, but for all men.
Was your father in the funeral business too?
My uncle was in the funeral. My dad was a lumber contractor.
Yes.
And he owned shares in the funeral business. He never was actually an undertaker.
Yes.
I lived with my father and uncle and worked with my uncle in the funeral business.
I see. With your uncle?
Pardon?
With your uncle?
Yes, yes. And so that was actually the beginning of our determination that we would really do something we could do. So we began then to go around and ask our people not to buy newspaper from the white boys who would come around through the neighborhood and sell newspaper. And that was a furniture company. We tried to get our people not to buy furniture because the white would come in and sit on the side of our parents' bed, and they would come in, open the door, and call our friends and our mothers by their first name. And we asked them, "Why do we have to say yes and no to the white, and they don't say it to us?" And my dad said, "Well, that's just an old custom, son, that it always has been that Negroes have to respect the white people." I said, "Dad, why can't they respect us?" He said, "Well, white people don't feel that we are supposed to be respected. They feel that we're just a piece of property, a tool or something to be used, and that they are our superiors and that they have no right and no reason to respect us." And I said, "Well, I feel that you've always told us, Dad, that we're good as anybody else." He said, "That's right." I said, "Then why should I say yes and no to them? They won't say yes and no to me. Or they won't say yes and no to you." He said, "Well, I don't know. It's something we just can't help." See, my father was not an educated man. He never finished the sixth grade. But he had a lot of common sense, and he had the nerve of a lion. You couldn't frighten him. And what gave Metcalfe out so much courage, too, was that he never let white people frighten him. I remember once we was at a commissary. A commissary is a little store where Negroes go and buy their commodities on Saturdays. And Dad had... We used to have a running account that you pay every Saturday. This particular Saturday we went in to pay the account, and the store owner, who was named Jimmy Boulware at that time, I never forget him, had a great reputation of beating Negroes and kicking Negroes, and if they didn't pay the bill that he said they owed. So this Saturday he gave my daddy a statement, and Dad said, "Well, Mr. Boulware, this is wrong. So I don't owe you this money." So he cursed him and told him he did owe him. He said, "You don't curse me." He said, "I don't owe you this money." And then Metcalfe and I were standing beside Dad, and the commissary was jam-packed with people. and with Negroes mostly, and a few white. So Boaz broke for his cash register draw, I guess, or for the little draw underneath the counter. And my dad jumped between he and the cash register and told him, said, look, if you open that cash and grab a bottle, and said, if you open that cash register, I'm gonna bust your brains out. At that time, Medgar and I received the picked up a bottle each and stood at the door. And my dad said, son, don't turn your back on them. He said, just stand there. And dad talked to him and told him, if you dare hit one of us, so we're all going down in here. And this white man stood there and trembled. He just shook like a leaf on a tree. And that alone let me know then that my dad only had a bottle. And he had a gun lying right inside. He's afraid to pick it up. So I knew then that white men, from a boy, are cowards. And they're easy to become excited if you show any type of nerve or any courage at all. They'll quick turn and run, or they'll tuck their tail.
Would you generalize that? You say a white man, would you generalize that all white men are cowards?
No, I wouldn't dare say all white men are cowards. I would say the type who live violently are cowards. Those who depend on violent means to secure their end are cowards. I've noticed that as we grew up, we watched the cowboy pictures, and we noticed how all the bad white men would always try to sneak hide and shoot the other brave man in the back. They would try to lay in the bushes and shoot him as he passed. So those type of things that built up in us that help us to understand that Negroes and white, to a certain extent, are the same. That a coward is a coward regardless of who he is. And most cowards react the same. And that was one of the reasons why that we felt that we should not be afraid of the whites. Stand up to them. Respect ourselves and respect them too, and demand respect from them. So we did that for clean through our boyhood days, and as we came into manhood, we went into the Army and served in the Army, World War II.
Both of us,
yes. Then we came back home in 1946, and we felt that at that time, you know, you didn't have to pay poll tax.
Let me interrupt a second.
Yes.
What branch of the service were you in? What branch was he in?
Well, we were in many different branches. That, you know, during World War II, the Army was segregated, so they'd put Negroes wherever they thought they could be served most. I went into the engineers, and I transferred from the engineers to the infantry, from infantry to the tank battalion. From a tank battalion, I got hurt in 1942 in Louisiana on maneuvers, the red and I believe blue, red and white or red and blue maneuvers, I believe it was. I got hurt on maneuvers, and then I was put into a limited service unit in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And I stayed there for, I guess, 2 years. My job there was transferring recruits to replacement centers. And then after I got back and recuperated, then they assigned me back to an engineer battalion. And I went overseas with the 13 engineers and went to Pacific, where we served in Pacific Theater for 3 years. And Metgill was with the military police department in France. He was in with the Normandy invasion. And he served there for 2.5 years. And then when we both came back in 1946, we decided we had always wanted to register, but we were too young before. So we were old enough now to register, and we wanted to register to vote. We began to work in our community, try to talk to the people of our community to get registered and voting.
Now this was Decatur again?
Decatur, yes, in Newton County. So then we had many hardships. The whites began to threaten our parents, and they began to threaten us, and Bilbo came back again and said, the way to stop these niggers from voting is to visit them the night before the election. And sure enough, they came the night before the election of 1946, I believe.
But you were registered then?
No, I hadn't registered.
Oh, I hadn't registered.
And told my father that if you don't stop these your sons from trying to register, something bad is going to happen to them. In the meantime, Medgar and I was in school now at Alcorn. We were coming home on weekends and pushing and working with the voter registration and organizing NAACP chapters. So then when we came home, my dad told us what he had said. And so I said, well, Dad, I went and fought in New Guinea, and I fought in the Philippines, and I'm willing to fight here in Mississippi to have the thing that we fought for there. I said, this is our country, and I don't care what no white man says. I'm going to stay right here in Mississippi and enjoy it. And if I can fight in there, fight there for it, I can stay and fight for it. And Metcalf felt the same way. And Metcalf said, and we're going to register. We care what they say. So that morning we went up to register and got to register. Got up to the place to register. Mr. Brand, at that time, who was circuit clerk, who had known us all our lives, he came out and said, come here, Charles, you and Metcalf. Carried us into the room and talked to him. Look, son, said, now, I don't have no right to tell you not to register, not to vote.
Said, this is registrar?
Registrar. He said, but it's going to cause trouble. And if I were you, I'd just go on back and wait. The time will come when you can register. And I told him now, I said, Mr. Brand, we have waited too long already. I said, I want to register now. Not tomorrow, but now. So he said, well, he says, you're going to cause trouble. I said, well, I don't care what the trouble is. I want to register. So he carried me in, and we registered.
Both of you?
Both of you registered. Then we went back. And the election was coming up, I believe, about 2 months later, 3 months later, so we could vote. And then we came back, and we got five others to register. We came back to vote. That's when the trouble really came. Then at this time, they had been threatening my dad and my parents all this time. I don't know if they come back, we're going to kill them. We're going to do that. So when we got back to Decatur to ready to vote for the election that fall, I think it was in November or that fall, then they must have had over 200, I guess, these white, I would say hoodlums, with shotguns and overall pants on and rifles. And this morning, Medgar and three other of our friends went down to vote. They blocked they had put the polls inside of a room, like inside this room here. And then they blocked the door with these whites. And Medgar and I pushed the door where the poll, where the booth was. First of going in to get our ballots, I was. They stopped us from, they tried to stop us from getting the ballot. So Mr. Brand said, let's just step aside, let them get the ballot. So when we went in again, he gave us our ballot. We came out, they blocked the booth where they blocked the door where the polling place was. And they, as I walked up, they rammed a shotgun in my side and said, I'll blow you half in two. Then one put a rifle in Medgar's side and said, you damn Evers niggas in that for trouble, no way. And I said to him, now, you don't have the guts to pull the trigger. I said, first place, you're a coward. I said, now, if you're going to kill me for one arrest, you kill me right here in the courthouse. And Medgar said, they're not going to do anything, Charlie. Don't worry about it. And by that time, another white man who we had worked and helped with, we'd raked his yards and we'd played with his sons. And we had, my mother, I remember once, had nursed his wife when she was sick, walked up and said that, you niggas going to get in trouble if you don't go on back home. Now you're going back home to Jim and Jesse and stop raising all this trouble, because they've been here all these years and they looked up on as the lead Negroes of our town, and no point in you creating no trouble for them. And I said, we're not creating any trouble for them, Mr. X. I said, the point of it is, we just decided that we want to have the same thing you have, and that's our freedom and right to register and vote. I said, we don't think that's any trouble. And he said, by that time, he said, well, if you don't get away from here, you're gonna wind up getting shot. And I said, well, you won't hardly shoot me if as long as I'm looking at you, but if we turn our back, you possibly will. And by that time, another white lady who we thought quite a bit of had heard what was going on. She came over. She said, Charles, make your plea. She said, they'll kill you. She said, go ahead on. And we said, well, okay then. And I told her, I said, look, you're beating us, but you haven't defeated us, and we'll be back. And I told Meg, I said, don't turn around, Meg, it's back out the door. Well, these other two fellas were at the door waiting for us. We backed out of the door.
Your friends?
Yes, our friends. And then they said, you damn Evers niggas gonna get all the niggas in Decatur killed if you don't stay at home and tend to your own business. So we didn't say anything. We all got outside on the courthouse square, and I told Matt, I said, look, you and the other two fellas go down one way, and the other two will go with me down in different directions. So as we're going down the street, here come about three or four carloads of these whites. They ran down beside, jumped out of the car, and that time I had as I always did usually do, we'd always be well armed, and so I said, listen, if you touch one of us, we're going to leave right in the streets. Now, we're not bothering you, don't you bother us, but nobody's going to take a whooping from any of you white folks, you understand that? We'll kill you niggas, you won't do nothing to me. I said, one thing about it, if you kill me, I'm going to get one of you first. Now, you just bleed at him. So they stood there and they cursed, so we kept on walking. They cursed us, they drove alongside and cursed all the way down the street.
Were they armed?
Yes, they were armed. Yes, they were armed. They had shotguns in the car. And they said, but sure, they're cowards. course, they felt good. We were going to fight back. So I said, don't follow me home. I said, now you follow me down to the tunnel, but you better not follow me on my property. So they followed us, not by, I said, 100 yards following. Then they turned around and went on back. You better not be in town when the night comes. So Metcalf and I decided we were going back to school, which was Alcorn.
Where was that?
Alcorn College, we were going back to school that afternoon. But so they said, you better not go back. Then we stayed because we felt they might bother our parents. And we had a barn out back in our property, which is it's inside the city limits, but it's at that time there was no ruling against having barns and chickens and cows. So we, asked Metcalf, said, you stay in the barn, and I'll get in the garage. We'll stay in there, and our other two friends stayed across the street in one of our rent houses. In case they came, what we have them put them in a crossfire. But in the army, we learned to, in case people should attack you, the best way is to get them in a crossfire, and you can't miss. And we felt they were going to come in large numbers. We planned to get them in a crossfire. So that night, we stayed all night. We sat up all night waiting for them to come, and they didn't come. And as soon as day broke, then we went home, went across the street to the house, and laid down and had a few hours rest. And got in, I had a 41 Ford at that time. And I got in my car, Metcalf and I got in the car next morning and drove back uptown and went into the courthouse and caught them unaware because they thought we were gone. We went into the court, no one was there. And we went in the courthouse, went into the circuit clerk's office and asked them, why do they feel the way they feel about us? He said, well, Charles, I told you before that it's just not time yet. And I said, well, when do you think the time will come? He said, well, I don't know, it's going to take time. And then we walked, turned, and well, thank you, turned and walked on out.
What kind of a man is a circuit court clerk?
I must say he was a fairly decent man. He actually didn't ever show any resentment towards us. He never showed where he was for us either. He seemed to be the type of person who wanted to advise against any possible trouble or any possible violence. He was not for a violent man.
You think he had some sense of the injustice of the situation, some regret about it, or not?
Yes, I do. I think he was a man who knew they were wrong. But the position he held, he knew that he would be crucified had he spoken out.
And that's what about the registrar?
The registrar?
Mr. Brand.
He's the same man.
I see.
Well, what happened, we had worked for Mr. Brand for a long time. And
Brand?
Brand, yes. We'd worked for him a long time, and we knew him, and he knew us. He knew my father, he knew my mother, he knew all of us. But we, you know, that's our home. And I feel that he was a fair man. There were many there who were fair. But these who were so bitter against us were, as I said before, and I've said many times, were the ignorant whites who had nothing to offer. And their only way of proving that they were somebody is try to keep the Negro depressed and deprived of his rights as a citizen, as an individual.
But there never was an attempt by the other white people in the neighborhood to interfere with this, stop this.
No. You see, in Mississippi, the white man who differed with the extremists are much more in danger than the Negro. Because reprisal would come to them much severe than would come to us. And that's why so many good white people in Mississippi are afraid to speak out. And there are many.
James Baldwin says in print that he's convinced by the testimony of Southern Negroes that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the white majority, but feels, as he says, a moral vacuum.
Partly I agree. I won't say it's the majority, but I'll say that I don't think that the mob represent all of the whites of Mississippi. I can't say that it doesn't represent the majority, because evidently it is the majority, because they seem to be too silent on it. A person having lived in Mississippi, it would be hard for them to judge on whether or not that that's the case. I've lived here all my life, with the exception of the 4 or 5 years I was away trying to save money to come back to Mississippi. I can't say that Mr. Baldwin was altogether truthful. I would say that there are a large majority of whites who do not approve this type of thing, but I can't say that they're in the majority. I think I would be exaggerating to say that there's a majority of the white of Mississippi feel that this thing we are fighting for and dying for is right.
But majority are not. They are passive or withdrawn from it. Anyway.
Oh, yes.
I don't want to interrupt the narrative. Go ahead and tell me more of this straight-ahead story, will you?
Well, I think we left off when we tried to register and vote.
That's right. You came back the next morning, yes, to the courthouse.
We came back the next. Then we went, got in our car and pursued back to the school. And when we got back to the school, we had many calls, many letters from home, from our native Negro friends, asking us, please don't come back to Decatur because they're going to kill us if we came back. And Medgar and I felt, until his assassination, that if we must go, then I'm willing to go in Mississippi. We took a chance in France, we took a chance in New Guinea, we took a chance in Manila, we took a chance in going to Japan. We had to invade Japan, but we'd already been alerted to go there, to fight for democracy, to fight for the things that this country was established for. Then if I've got to come back to Mississippi, the two of us felt this way, and be denied of these things, then my fighting and my sacrifice, that all the years I sacrificed in the Army, has been in vain. Then if I have the nerve and the courage to go and face people I've never seen before, never heard of, and never even spoken to, well, the least we could do is stay here and face people who we grew up with, and who we knew we've served, who've served us, who we have worked beside, who we've played beside. Then if I don't have the nerve to stand up to them and tell them what I want, then we must be a phony all the way. And we don't believe that we are phonies, and we didn't believe in that. And we felt that we must let Mississippi know, as I still feel, and Metcalf felt, that this is our state. And we went and fought for this country as well as anybody else. And all we want out of it is an equal opportunity, no more or no less. Therefore, when we went back to Alcorn, we began to continue to work. And we came back home the next weekend, and nothing happened to us. And we went back home until we finished school. Then when we came out of school, I went in and took over the funeral parlor, which we had in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And Medgar then went into Mound Bayou and headed up a insurance company. At that time, the president was Dr. T.R.M. Howard, who we looked on more or less as a father and as a, well, he was everything, counselor to us, because he was one of the few men who seemed to understand what Medgar and I wanted. And he was one of the few Negroes in Mississippi at that time who were willing to stand by us and push us and urge us on.
As most Negroes were willing to stand aside, is that it, that period?
Well, they weren't willing, they were afraid.
Well, afraid.
They were afraid. I wouldn't dare say that no Negro, including the Uncle Toms, as we call them, don't want the same thing, or didn't want the same thing that Medgar and I wanted. But many of them didn't have the courage and the guts to be willing to stand up.
Always hopelessness, too.
Yes. And they always felt that it was a hopeless and a useless fight. That the white man was in charge, and he always remained in charge. That this was his country, and he would control it. What we were trying to get our people to see, what I'm still trying to get them to see, what Metcalf died trying to get them to see, is that this is not any one person's country. It's a country of all the people. And it's only yours if you put forth and exert every effort that you have to let the world know that you are willing to pay the supreme sacrifice, as all other great Americans did, to make it a better place to live. And one of the greatest ways of that is through political participation, register and vote, education, self-denial, self-respect, and respect others, and demand respect from them.
How much progress do you think has been made in that way in the last 15 years?
A tremendous amount. More than we had ever dreamed would come. I think there were many instances of what brought about the war, the two wars that we had. You see, the Negro in Mississippi has always been denied communication, association with other people, with people who learned and who had been exposed. You see, a person's intelligence is no greater than his exposure. We in Mississippi had been, most of us were reared up on farms, and we've been worked for in these kitchens and in these backyards and on these plantations, but nothing, and that's all we ever got. My father, I don't think ever, he left Mississippi one time. He lived 68 years and left Mississippi once. Went to Chicago to visit my sister on her dying bed. So therefore, he knew nothing but Mississippi. And there are millions, I mean thousands, should I say, of Negroes who have never been out of Mississippi, who never been 50 miles from where they were born. So therefore, until World War II came, we thought that the whole world was just like Mississippi. We had no ambitions, we had no outlook on the world or life. And then by going into the war coming, and they threw all of us in the army with men from all over the world and all over the country. And listen to them talk and see how free they were. And when I went in the army and found a boy, I had finished high school, and here's a boy who hadn't even finished eighth grade, was much more abreast, much more learned than I was. He could discuss things that I hadn't even heard of. And I knew then that there must be a better place. And Mississippi has deprived us of all of the things that others are getting throughout this country.
The same thing's true to a substantial degree of the white boy growing up too, isn't it?
As the white of Mississippi are in the same predicament we are. And our basic trouble here is ignorance.
On both sides.
White and Negro. We just haven't been exposed to anything. And the only thing that the poor whites know and the poor Negroes know is what these politicians get up and holler on radio and newspapers and television. Therefore, he feels that there's not a line of communication between Negroes and white, and they don't know what the Negro wants. Other than this politician who's in there for his own personal gain. He's saying that all Negroes want to do is to come down and marry your daughter and destroy your homes. He never said that all the Negro want is an equal education, to learn to be a first-class citizen. He never said that Negroes want to be able to participate in political affairs. He never said that Negroes want to equip himself educationally where he'd be able to serve in any educational capacity he's needed. He never said Negro want to be lawyers, doctors, and where he can nurse and where he can doctor on any patient who needs medical care. He never said that Negroes want to be dignitaries to go out and represent our state, our country. But all that he showed is that Negroes want to become intimate with your daughter. And no man approve of anyone wanting to become intimate with his wife, his daughter. So they know that's a good weapon they can use. And they hammer away at that. That all they want to do is intermarriage. And they never say that Negroes are equal to anyone else. Give them a chance. Therefore, Negroes are inferior because they've been beaten on their head all their lives that you are not as good as that white man. And it's going to take time for Negroes to realize that he is as good as anyone if he demands equal, if he prepare himself to become as equal to anyone else.
Do you think the nonviolence technique has been the key of success so far?
I do. The only way that we have is through nonviolence. There's no other way. Violence has never accomplished anything in our fight. It would only destroy everything that we have gained to turn to violence.
You know, of course, that there are people, Negroes, who disagree with you, that the time for violence is probably coming. But the threat of violence is the only weapon that will finally break certain localities.
That's said, of course. Well, here's what I feel. I don't believe in violence, but I believe in this. I believe in self-preservation, and I believe in protecting yourself. Now, you remember a few minutes ago I said that Metgen and I always try to protect ourselves.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't mean that we are violent, because if I don't let you come into my home and drag my son out and lynch him, now, I'll say this. I wouldn't ask any Negro anymore to be driving along his car and let a bunch of white hoodlums drive beside him and snatch him and beat him. Or come into his home and drag his son or his daughter out, or his wife out and beat him. Now, we don't consider when we protect our people in that respect as violence. But what I'm speaking of violence, to arm ourselves and go down and start shooting people on the streets, start going downtown as they do us, beating them up as the white have done us all these years, taking them by their hand and by their feet, dragging them and hanging them in the trees and shooting them in two like they did Mr. Tanger many years ago. Now that's the type of violence we don't believe in. But now, I don't want nobody ever think that I don't believe in protecting myself or protecting my home or my family. Because
now, for either on or off the record as you choose, you see, we will put it down, you can cut it out of the transcript if you like. Take a case like the Jackson College student situation, where there is an immediate provocation and a flare-up, you see, of anger. And then the stoning of cars, as I understand it, started, indiscriminate stoning of cars. Now, I've talked with several people here in Jackson, several Negroes. None of them quite agree as what should be done about this, you see. Some have said that they thought that it should have been encouraged, that an outburst would have blown the lid and meant federal interference. Some take the line you took, as I understand it, that you tried to break it up and put the crowd of students back into order and withdraw from the streets. Is that right?
Right.
And that you went among them and tried to break it up.
Yes.
And even after the shooting, that your policy, if it's represented to me correctly, it may not be correctly represented, was to withdraw them from the streets.
Right. That is true. I don't feel that, as I said before, that violence will aid us at all. The thing that happened at Jackson College is understandable for any group.
It's humanly understandable, yes.
But I don't think that we should resort to that, because that's the same thing that the white man has used all the time, violence. And that's why he's being destroyed all over this land. And if we turn to violence, we're going to, as I've said before, defeat our purpose and our aims and our objectives. We are gaining. We're winning. It's obvious. It's evident. And the reason why that our country today is slipping into third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, or ninth, even 12th place is because of the violent tactics that have been used and the reprisals have been used against other people in other lands. So we started thinking, and Jackson College, I felt that the kids, I told them, the greatest accomplishment can be made is through negotiation. Now, you have a right to protest, but I don't condone throwing bottles, cursing, being disrespectful towards anyone. Now, you've done the same thing, as I told them, that these policemen have done and are doing. You're showing inferiority. Anytime you have to resort to profanity, to rock throwing, and through gun play, then you are in fear, because you feel that you are not quite capable to stand up and compete against another man as a man to man. And I want them not to go downtown demonstrating. That wasn't the answer. But be firm and demand that something be done on the campus and stay on the campus.
If nothing were done, though, should there be a demonstration? Of course, you can't ask this because generally, perhaps, because situations change.
I think, as you've said, I think that's something that has to wait and see if nothing has done. Now, something has been done.
Yes, I know. I saw it.
Through that, and don't get me wrong, I think that was a good thing, that the flare-up itself was a good thing. Because I personally have been asking the city of Jackson to place a light or some type of protection on it for the kids. And they had told me that it was being studied by the engineer department.
Were you in the committee that went to the mayor?
Yes.
You personally?
No. I didn't go to the mayor. He won't ever see me. The mayor won't even talk to me.
Reverend Horton went, didn't he?
I believe so. Reverend Horton, Reverend Smith, I think they went to.
And then the mayor later said that nobody had come to him. Is that right?
Well, the mayor has even said that no one at all had ever said, and even the Board of Education said they had asked, and they had requested, and money had been set aside for an overpass, but then the mayor said he didn't know anything about it at all.
Yep, there had been a committee calling on
him. Oh, yes, there had been a committee calling on him. Well, see, the mayor feels in Jackson that he is not obligated to Negroes because, as I tell them all the time, Negroes do not vote in Jackson. But if Negroes were voting in Jackson, the mayor would have a different tune. And that's why we are putting forth every effort that we possibly can to get Negroes registered. Because we know that through registration and through selective buying are the two greatest weapons that the Negro has.
Let me ask about the trial of Beckwith. Or how did the verdict strike you? Now, I run across the notion that it was rigged. I run across the notion that it was an honest split of opinion. I've heard many views of this.
Since this won't come out until after, I guess, the conviction or the...
It won't come out until midsummer anyway.
I've withheld any comment on it.
I know you have.
But all I can say is that...
You can put a date on this if you want to.
Yes. All I would like it to come out until after the whatever the thing decision be. I feel that, and I guess maybe I'm a little liberal in my thinking, that there was someone on this jury who wanted justice done. And I feel that the prosecutor did everything in his power along with his aides and the Jackson Police Department to bring about justice Not because Medgar was Medgar Evers, because he's my brother. But I feel that they did it because they felt a crime had been committed. And I feel that somewhere that there's been a change of heart among men in Mississippi, some men. And I feel that they did the very best they could.
Some really, really, it was an honest job.
I actually believe that. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, of course, it's always possible.
I could be wrong. But as I said before, they say it was rigged. Well, if it was rigged, it was the first time in the history of Mississippi that even they even thought enough of a Negro to even rig a trial to make it look like
to that. Even try to impress the outside
world. So I feel that it won't bring Medgar back, and Medgar wouldn't want it any other way. He wouldn't want me to feel any. I know Medgar. We, like I said, we was almost indispensable, and he wouldn't want me to say anything else other than I feel that somebody wanted to see justice done.
That's an encouraging thought. Tell me this, where does his family live now?
It's still the same location, 2332 Gaines, yes. Same location. And as I said, I think Mrs. Edwards feels practically the same way I do. As I said, Meck and I never believed in violence. We never believed in retaliation. And we never believed in trying to belittle anyone because of our personal feeling. And we know that all of them didn't agree. But I truly believe that and I appreciate what the prosecuting attorney did, the district attorney.
You think it was really a vigorous prosecution?
I really do. And I also appreciate the jurors who were men enough to say that this was wrong and let the world know. Now, who they were, I don't know.
Do you think there'll be a leak in reprisals against those jurors?
I hope not. I don't see why there should be. I also think that the Jackson Police Department did a wonderful job in collecting evidence and getting witnesses. I appreciate that.
That's a strange division in the department, isn't it? They will go for this collection of evidence, yet other officers will testify contrary to the drift of the evidence. The officers who said they had seen your brother, you know, gave him an alibi. I mean, Beckwith gave Beckwith an alibi at the time that he was presumably close to your brother's house.
Well, as I said, that's individuals, and as I said, I like to give credit to only and those who were against us. As I said before, they've been against us all the time. But I feel that any officer who does his job, not because it was Medgar, not because he was a Negro, but because he was a human being and that a crime had been committed. And it's their duty as a police officer to collect all the evidence that they possibly could, and I believe they did that.
That they had some sense of the ethics of their own job,
right.
Nothing else.
I believe from a moral standpoint, if nothing else, they did a good job.
I'm going to switch the tape now.
Okay.